You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and if you are listening to this show on the podcast, you can listen to it live Wednesdays, 5 o'clock after calendar, and also on Saturdays at 12:30. Today, we're going to be talking about a really hopeful book. And I think all of you are ready for a journey to hope, aren't you? The book is called The Revolution Where You Live, and it's by Sarah Van Gelder. Some of you have already met or heard of Sarah because you subscribe or pick up Yes Magazine at our local library. She's edited several books, but this is a book that she wrote. It's a memoir. And she wrote it all by herself. It's stories from a 12,000-mile journey through a new America. And I'd like to welcome Sarah. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
This book, let's read a review. The Revolution Where You Live couldn't have come at a better time. If Woody Guthrie had penned a book to go along with This Land Is Your Land, it might have read like this. And that was David Bornstein from the New York Times. And also Bill McKibben, and he's the founder of 350.org. And he says, what a journey. Sarah Van Gelder uncovers the real revolution unfolding across America. Leaderless and leaderful, up against it and angry, but still willing to hope. A passionate, powerful account. And that's certainly where we are now, Sarah. And so let's talk about this book and your journey. I'd like to start with your early history and what led you to a life of activism.
Well, it goes back to when I was pretty young. I was in India for a year as a child. My father had an exchange, so my whole family was there. And I encountered a kind of poverty that I just had never seen before as a young person growing up in a small town in Maryland. I encountered people my own age who were out on the street begging, who couldn't go to school the way I could go to school, who didn't have a safe place to sleep at night. And it just was something I couldn't reconcile with what I'd been taught, which was by my parents, which was that, you know, every person matters and every person is has a place in the Quaker faith. Every person is a reflection of the divine.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't reconcile those two, and I remember feeling like, well, I'm only a kid. I don't really understand stuff, but I'm going to understand it as I grow up, and then I'm going to see what I can do about it. You know, as somebody who has the privilege of going to bed every night and having a place to sleep and having enough to eat, you know, I can't just leave these other children behind. I have to do what I can do to make a different kind of world.
Mm-hmm.
So that really did kind of define a lot of what I wanted to understand. I wanted to understand injustice. I wanted to understand what was the source of that and what could be the source of a different kind of society.
And you also spent some time in Guatemala, I believe. What happened there?
That was when I was a young adult, and I spent 4 months traveling in that country and did research as I was traveling and before I left about the relationship of the United States to the country, and learned that there had been a very progressive government elected back in the mid-50s, and this president had wanted to do land reform, had wanted to do some actions that were considered radical at the time, even though he was not talking about taking land away from people who are using it. He was talking about unused land that large corporations like the United Fruit Company weren't using to grow food or to grow anything, and paying them for that land and making it available to farmers who didn't have enough space to grow the food that they would need to survive. And the U.S. government colluded along with the CIA with some local reactionaries and overthrew that government.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, there were decades of civil war in Guatemala, and many, many people killed. So
yeah.
As I was traveling
ongoing
through
injustice.
Guatemala, I was learning about that story.
Mm-hmm. And then you came home, and you found yourself at Point Madison, right, in Suquamish. And
right.
There was
lots happened in between, but yes, I was on the Port Madison reservation, and I still live adjacent to the Port Madison reservation, and it's been a wonderful experience to get to know the folks in the Suquamish tribe and to have been able to play a small role in restoring some of their ability to exercise their sovereign rights on the reservation. We can talk more about what some of those stories are if you want. That's how I start the book out.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then you found a way to make your activism and spread it to more people. And you were one of the founders of Yes Magazine right there on the Kitsap Peninsula. So what led to its founding and what is its purpose as a magazine?
So we were founded in 1996, and a group of us had been working at a different magazine, In Context magazine, when the founders decided to close it. And so some members of the board and some members of the staff decided that we wanted to spin off a new magazine, and that was how Yes got started. And our purpose all along has been to tell the story of what is possible for our society moving forward. We hear a lot in the news about how things are coming unraveled, or critiques about the environment, the large corporations that cause the environmental crisis, and people not being able to get along. And our question has always been, well, what are people doing instead? What are the alternatives? If we don't like the way things are happening, if we don't like global capitalism, what are people creating instead? And so we've looked at that as a journalistic question and found out that people all over the world, and certainly in our country, are voting with their hands and voting with their feet to create a very different kind of a society. And so each issue of Yes Magazine describes some aspect of how that's unfolding.
So just like Mother Earth News provided back to the landers with ideas and suggestions for being self-sufficient, Yes Magazine offers some answers to inequality and the environmental harm and poverty.
That's right. And those tend to seem to be interconnected questions. You know, there's once you start looking at any one aspect of it, you find that both the problem is interconnected, but a lot of the solutions, the alternatives, also address more than one aspect of that problem.
Mm-hmm. And you met many people along your way. Let's talk about this book and what led you to decide to leave your home and probably take a little break from working hard on the magazine and other writings and travel 12,000 miles around the United States. How did your journey begin and what were you looking for?
Well, this is about the time of the 20th anniversary of Yes Magazine, and it was early 2015, and I was thinking about these issues that we've been looking at all these years and just feeling like, you know what, you know, we have found some people doing great work, and yet in all the three areas that I was especially concerned about, it looked to me like things were still getting worse. Mm-hmm. And it just made me wonder, you know, are there answers out there that we haven't found yet? Are there places that people are figuring some stuff out and we need to be reporting on it, but we don't know about them yet? And I especially felt like that may be true in some of the areas that are so, of our country that are so often ignored, the Midwest, the Rust Belt, the Indian reservations, the Appalachia, some of the places that are poor and remote and, you know, some people describe them as flyover country. Mm-hmm. This was before the election was really on the horizon. So it's not so much looking at, you know, who's going to vote for whom for president. I was really interested in at the grassroots. Are there groups that are figuring out ways to make their own communities better? And could we learn from them? So that's what I went out looking for.
That's right. That's right. And that's what I found really wonderful reading this book was the exposure to people and places that I would not normally go to. It's really a book of hope. So let's go on and talk some more about it. So you were looking for local activism or projects that were about climate change, and also kind of a way to counteract the extractive economy. I really love that term. I hadn't heard it before, the extractive economy. And so from here, you headed right out to coal country, to Montana. And we would think that you wouldn't find anybody that was working against big coal or big oil out there, but you did. So why don't you tell us about Otter Creek Valley?
So I originally found out about it because before I left, while I was still here in Suquamish, just outside Seattle, I learned that the Lummi tribe had been fighting a great big, huge, new proposed coal terminal, which would have been the largest in the United States. And I couldn't figure out why would there be such a need for so much export capacity of coal. Where was all that coal going to come from?
Mm-hmm.
So I looked into it and found out that there is a brand new strip mine, and which would have been the largest in Montana, a coal strip mine proposed for the Otter Creek Valley. It's in southeast Montana. And so I decided to go there and find out what the story was. You know, maybe the locals were okay with that. And I was just curious. So I traveled to southeast Montana. I stayed with Elena Buffalo Spirit on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation and learned that the Northern Cheyenne tribe is, in fact, very much opposed to it. And I also interviewed a number of ranchers who actually ranched the land where that coal mine would be dug, or ranch areas nearby, and found out that they were also very much opposed to it. These were people who have ranched on this land. Their family's been on the land for generations. They love their way of life. They love the countryside. And it's actually quite beautiful. I didn't know if it would be, you know, what some of us here in the Pacific Northwest, mm-hmm. we may consider, if it doesn't have, you know, snow-covered mountains nearby and beautiful salt water, that it's just wasteland, you know. But it is just beautiful land.
Big
with
sky.
The National Forest.
Rocks, across, trees.
Absolutely.
Yes. So that was unexpected. The ranchers that have been actually fighting coal for decades, and we've got still the low coal prices and people more interested in wind and more interested in solar as time goes on, because even the corporations are seeing that that's going to be the way to go. So then you went on to oil fracking country in North Dakota. You met some people there and also were on another reservation, Turtle Mountain. Tell us about what they're working on.
Sure. I mean, one of the amazing things about both the Turtle Mountain and the Otter Creek situation is in both cases, the communities won in their struggles to keep those extraction enterprises out. So in the Otter Creek Valley, that coal mine, which would have extracted 1.2 billion tons of coal for export to Asia, was canceled.
Mm-hmm.
In the Turtle Mountain Reservation, an elder brought together the women, saying, you know, the women have responsibility in our tradition for protecting the water, and we should understand what this fracking thing is before it comes here, because, you know, this will be a major turning point. Could be a major turning point for us. And the women who researched it got very alarmed at the potential for contaminating their groundwater. Brought it to the tribal council. The tribal council held a big community meeting and eventually agreed to ban fracking from the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Reservation. And when I was there, I interviewed the tribal chairman and said, well, you know, how do you feel about this? This was a couple years ago. You've essentially left millions of dollars on the table, and it's a pretty impoverished tribe, as most tribes are. And he said, you know, I believe that money doesn't buy happiness. All you have to do is look at the boom country at Port Berthold, where there's been this enormous fracking boom, to mm-hmm. see all the corruption and human trafficking and crime and so forth that have been drawn to that area by the fracking boom mm-hmm. and the pollution. And he said, I believe in making money the old-fashioned way, by earning it. So he and the rest of the tribe seemed very happy with the solution that they had reached to ban fracking and instead to turn to especially wind, but also solar energy.
And so that leads us to a term that you use in the book, creating a restorative economy. And can you elaborate about what your vision of a restorative economy is?
The current economy has so many aspects of extraction. Just take the oil and the gas out of the ground and burn it, or just take the time of people's labor and give them the minimum possible in wages and extract the value of the rest of that labor to make some people very wealthy. So it has all these aspects of extraction, and then we call that economic growth. We add that into the gross domestic product and say that's a successful economy. But a restorative economy is one where all of the activities of our economy also put back into our society, into our commons, into our well-being. So, for example, some of the co-ops that I visited, they make sure that when they do produce windows and doors or grow food, that they're doing so in a way that restores the soil or makes sure that the energy efficiency is taken into account. Make sure that people are paid a decent wage so that they can build up the assets to make sure their children can go to college and can have a good life. So an economy that continues to put back value into the community and into the people working there, that's the kind of restorative economy that I think is so interesting.
Mm-hmm. I want our listeners to know that this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. You're listening to Book Lovers Cafe. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and we are talking to Sarah Van Gelder. She's the author of The Revolution Where You Live, and she is the co-founder of Yes Magazine. We're having a very hopeful conversation, and she's telling us stories because she traveled around the United States in 2015, and she found a lot of reasons to be hopeful that are continuing today into 2016 and 2017. And so we're going to bring that hope to you. And Sarah, then you go to our big urban centers, the places that we are led to believe through the media and through some of our politicians are completely falling apart: Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit. And so what did you find that could bring us hope for what's happening in those cities and in those communities?
Well, I think one of the things that's happened is that people are starting to turn away from the economic development model that holds that, you know, that our best strategy is to bring in large corporations and hope that they'll provide us jobs. Because the truth is that they often just pick up those jobs and move them elsewhere if people start asking for decent wages or environmental standards. So instead, what they're doing is starting to look at what a rooted economy looks like. How do we do that in our cities? One great example of that is in Cincinnati, Ohio, where the faith community and the labor unions and a lot of community groups are all collaborating to develop worker-owned co-ops that are also unionized.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure that the jobs are rooted with the people who live in the community, and those people have a long-term stake in both the success of the business, but also they have a stake in the success of the community and the air quality where they live and the children and how they're going to be brought up, and investing in making that community a wonderful place to live. And it's interesting because there's also an ethic of enough in that kind of a setting. They don't have to make tons and tons of money and send it to a Wall Street investor to keep them happy. They just need to make enough money to pay everyone a decent wage and to put back into the business and make their contribution to the community. And so there's a sense of enoughness which makes some kinds of enterprises possible here in the United States that might otherwise only be possible if they were exported abroad.
I was particularly struck by the thoughts of Dr. Victor Garcia. I was very impressed with his ideas, and he thought that so much of the gun violence was a symptom of the multi-generational poverty in the communities. And he talked about the Waterfields Microgreens Project, which our listeners could look into. I drew a picture of a cluster of community businesses on my page here. And so that was very inspirational. Also, in Detroit, we think of Detroit now as this big wasteland, and there are people who have begun activist centers there that have been working for a long time. I'd never heard of Grace Lee and Jimmy Boggs before, and then people that are continuing on, like the very inspirational Halima Cassells. Can you tell me a little bit about her?
So she's a young mother And I actually, on my book tour, I stopped in Detroit to do a couple of book readings and got to spend some time with her again and get caught up with her. She's a young mother. She believes in not only the sort of worker ownership model that we were talking about, but also what she calls DIT, which is do it together. It's like DIY, only it's done as a group. Mm-hmm. So she organizes all sorts of things like that. She organizes a clothing swap so that for moms whose kids are outgrowing their clothes, they can pass them along to someone else. She's very involved in the time banking. So she's an artist. She loves doing artwork and trading it to people for things like help fixing up her home or doing paperwork for a project she cares about. So she's very interested in not only how do we get basic needs met, but how do we do so in a way that's actually brings enjoyment and a sense of community and a sense of conviviality to our lives. Mm-hmm. I think we get so serious about just, you know, jobs, we forget that life is about more than the economy. It's about how do we actually spend our time, and how can we do that in a way that we're getting our needs met, but we're also having great relationships with our neighbors and friends and trading things and helping each other out and sharing.
Mm-hmm. And she is making a living with all her ideas. And I wrote down, work and spend less, create and connect more. I think that's a great philosophy to have. Create and connect more. That's what we want to be all about here in Port Townsend. Then you went on to Kentucky. Here we have a very old coal economy, and it's kind of considered to be quite a racist state. And so you were interested in also what we can do to heal this divide. And right now, you know, there is such a backlash against minorities and against immigrants. And so what did you find in Appalachia that gave you hope?
Well, I found efforts especially started by young people, some of whom had previously left the region. In fact, there's a lot of young people who just leave because they just don't believe that there's going to be any hope, any jobs, any future for them there. And a number of those people have come back or convinced their peers not to leave in the first place. And they're in the process of trying to define what is a different kind of future for our region, because they can see that coal is on its way out, despite what the president says, that era is over, both because of the climate change issues and because of the economics. So they're saying there's something else that we have here. We have other. We're not only worth a commodity in this region. We're worth so much more. We have so much more to offer. So they've been doing that in part based on the local culture. The Appalachia, of course, has this beautiful old-time culture of music and art, and they're bringing back night spots where people can go out and enjoy the music together, and they're looking for alternatives to the prison economy, because some have promoted bringing in prisons as an economic development strategy, and they're saying, no, let's not do that. Let's invest that same kind of resources instead in local entrepreneurs who might be growing food and trading it, or a local whiskey brewery that is actually located in the town that I visited. Let's invest in the local entrepreneurs who have that kind of a talent to bring.
To turn that $450 million was what you said that the new prison was going to cost. And then, well, why not have a drug rehabilitation center? Why not have 35 local companies with 10 people each? And those are such great ideas, and also very, very hopeful to think that there are people living in those small holler towns that are thinking that way. You talk also about import substitution, and I think that can really resonate here in Port Townsend. What do you mean by import substitution and you know, working locally?
Yeah, and that's an idea that Jane Jacobs has developed and other people over the years, so it's not an original idea of mine, mm-hmm. but basically the idea is that if you're looking for opportunities to create jobs and to create local a local economy, one of the first places to look is at anything you're spending money on in your community that's immediately going outside your community. So, for example, if we're buying electricity and that means all the money we pay to our local utility is immediately going outside to buy coal-fired electricity or to pay large executive salaries, what if we could instead generate a certain amount of that locally? Or what if we could weatherize buildings, homes, and businesses so that people were spending less and that money then could stay in the community? So every time you plug one of those holes, you can think of it as a hole in a bucket. So every one of those holes is draining money out of the community. And every time you plug one of those and say, no, we could say, you know, reduce our energy expenditures by 20, 30, 40% if we did these weatherization things, we create local jobs for the people doing the weatherization, and we keep money in the pockets of the homeowners and business owners who would then be not spending so much on energy. So that's just one example. If you look at any place where we're spending money as a community that's going out of the community, that also represents an opportunity to bring that money and that economy home.
And there's a lot of retirees here that have investment accounts. You make the point of the fact that, you know, that money is going, once again, just out to the corporations and the multinationals, and it's not helping, you know, our town and our local businesses. So there are ways to invest, actually, in businesses in Port Townsend, and that's something to be thinking about here.
That's right. It's something I'm so impressed by, your local mercantile store, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, Quimper Mercantile, and it's an owner cooperative. So people, this was an empty store, and people bought shares, and it has been going on for a few years now and is very successful. I know some people that work there.
Yeah, that's a great model. And then, you know, something as common as a credit union. If you put your savings in a credit union or you use it for your checking account, that money is going to circulate back in your own community. It's not going to be going to Wall Street to speculate on some global finance shady deal. Mm-hmm. So that's another simple thing to do. Especially, I think a lot of people have become aware of this with the Standing Rock controversy, because mm-hmm. so many of the big banks were behind the Dakota Access Pipeline. But your local credit union is a pretty safe place to put your money if you want to make sure not to get involved in those kinds of projects.
That's right. So once again, the three areas that you are working on to help build activism and build awareness of what individual people and small groups of people can do. We've talked about climate change. We've talked about new economies at a local level, and also anti-racism and being able to understand the various minorities in our communities. This book will help, I think, people become inspired, and you end with many ideas. And here in Port Townsend, we already have the foundation. So you pretty much just have to step out your door and flag somebody down and say, what are you involved in, and what can I do to help? That's kind of my thoughts on it. Probably our newest organization is our Indivisible organization called the Sunrise Huddle. It meets once a month. It's going to be meeting on Tuesdays at the Unity Center on San Juan. I recommend that you get in touch with them if you're interested in political action. So once again, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us here. And we look forward to seeing you in our town soon and later on in the year. And you have been listening to KBTZ and Book Lovers Cafe. I'd like to thank very much Mike Schlechter, who's in the booth with me, and Larry Stein, and everyone else, all our 100 volunteers that keep this station on the air for you. Stay tuned to hear another great show right after me, and we'll see you next time.